I just want to quickly say thank you to all of you for attending this event. Say thank you to Yana Hernova and Holly Griffith, who helped put this together, part of the team at the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center. I also want to sort of throw in the trite line that we hear all the time, especially after Election Day. Elections have consequences, and to me, I'm extraordinarily grateful that the consequence of last year's defeat of ballot issue one didn't end the conversation around drug sentencing reform and criminal justice reform more broadly. In many respects, it just kicked it off, and kicked it off in a wonderfully dynamic way, and we're incredibly fortunate to have a wonderfully dynamic panel to sort of tell us both where we are and where we may be going, both in the state, and then in the afternoon we'll be putting that in the context of national trends and development. So I hope all of you can stay for the day. It'll include lunch and hearing from the governor's representative too about the governor's vision of where criminal justice issues are going in the state and should be going. And so without further ado, I'm happy to hand it over to Sarah Andrews, both to make opening remarks and to moderate our first panel.
All right, thank you. And thank all of you for coming this morning. We're happy to have you here. First and foremost, let me thank Ohio Government Television. They're back there in the back and in the middle, and we're live streaming in room 281 if we have an overflow space. So thank you for your work in helping us put this on, and also our great facilities team here at the Supreme Court of Ohio. They have been tremendous in making this happen. And last but not least, of course, Chief Justice O'Connor. So thank you for letting us be co-hosts. The commission is proud to co-sponsor this event. And we hope, like Professor Berman said, it will be informative, maybe a little feisty, that'd be good, and give us some insight on the future of criminal justice reform in Ohio. This morning, our try to limit their answers so that everyone has a chance to weigh in, as well as leave time for a few questions from the audience. I won't read the bios of the panelists today. You have that information available on the registration site. I will say, though, they are all an integral part of how we got here and where we go next. So please join me in thanking them for their leadership, and let's jump right in. First, let's start with each of you taking 1 or 2 minutes to introduce yourself and share with us how or why you are part of Ohio's criminal justice reform efforts. And so we'll start with Chief Justice O'Connor.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for obviously putting this together. Professor Berman, Sarah, and all of the other membership that has been instrumental in this, I think this is great to talk about where we've been in the last year, where we want to go. There's a lot of movement going forward. We've got HB 1 and SB 3, and we're going to get into that later. How am I involved in this? I was very, I've been involved in, obviously, as a trial judge, prosecuting attorney, and I think probably many, many people in this room have evolved in their thought processes from when you may have been in office or doing this, being involved in this topic in the 80s and the 90s, and now here we are. I think our national policy with regards to reform, criminal justice reform, has changed. Science has helped that a great deal, especially in this day and age. So we have to be open to these changes and incorporate them into, you know, the marriage between law and practical application, and not forgetting the human factor. And that's exactly what we're dealing with, is human beings when we talk about particularly a drug reform, but also when we talk about pretrial reform, and when we talk about reform in our Department of Rehab and Corrections, our institutions. And these are all things that I've been evolved on, and I guess the new phrase is I got woke. You know, it's not, I haven't been woke that recently. This is something that I've been involved with for quite some time. I think we're moving in a good direction, and I look forward to the discussion.
All right, thank you. Daniel?
start speaking, it'll just turn on. My name is Daniel Dew. I'm a legal fellow at the Buckeye Institute. We are a free market think tank, and historically, when you think of free market think tanks, you think of taxes and regulation and other more economic issues. And so we're really involved in criminal justice reform for a few reasons. First and foremost is that we are interested in removing government barriers that government doesn't impede people's ability to provide for themselves, for their families, and contribute to society. So that's one reason. And obviously, either being incarcerated or even a criminal record can greatly impede a person's ability to provide for themselves and their family. Another reason is that our prisons is our third highest budget item. We spend almost $2 billion a year on our prison systems. It's third behind Medicaid and education. And 95% of the people that we send to prison are going to return someday. And so we need to really look at, are we getting a good return on our investments as Ohioans? Are our communities safer because of what we're doing? Are we allowing people to reach their full potential? And that's why we're involved in this issue.
The Alliance for Safety and Justice. We are involved for a few key reasons. Our organization is devoted to a mission to reduce incarceration and direct resources to underserved victims of crime and to prevent crime from happening, with this recognition that we have seen this extreme jump in incarceration, often for people who do not pose a public safety risk, but a severe divestment in addressing the harms that victims of crime experience. To that end, we have worked across the country and including in Ohio in establishing trauma recovery centers. We worked with then Attorney General Mike DeWine, now Governor, in establishing that second highest number of trauma recovery centers to better support victims of crime. We are working specifically to enhance public safety. What we know is that often they are concentrated, there are populations who experience repeat victimization. We know that many of the symptoms of unaddressed trauma can lead people in a way that undermines safety and their health and well-being. One of those being that unaddressed trauma leads people to drug use. So by supporting people who have experienced trauma, who have experienced victimization, we see that as a crime prevention mechanism. To that end, it goes back to being very cognizant of the fact that our prison systems are overcrowded, have been for years, for a multitude of different reasons. We're approaching conversations of having to build a new prison, largely because we have people in our prisons who shouldn't be there because they're not posing a public safety risk. This is why we're here today, understanding that our goal is to increase public safety, reduce crime, prevent crime from happening, and ensure that we are investing our public dollars in what we want to see growing. We have invested largely in incarceration. It's no surprise that it's a top budget item for the state of Ohio. We'd like to see investments in reducing crime, supporting victims of crime, and ensuring that our communities are safer.
Thank you.
Good morning, Bill Seitz. I'm a House Majority Leader in the Ohio House of Representatives. Been in the General Assembly for the last 19 years, and throughout that time, I've been a member of the criminal justice committees of either the Senate or the House. Been a lawyer for 41 years, a long time. Although it's mostly a civil practice. I first became involved in these issues, obviously as a member of the House committee, but more to the point, in Hamilton County, which at the time was a fairly conservative county, the voters were asked not once but twice by a bipartisan coalition of leaders to appropriate monies to build a new and larger jail, and both times the folks in Hamilton County said no, and rather resoundingly. So that caused me to start thinking, well, we're going to have to come up with some other approaches, because these folks are not willing to put their money where their law and order mouth is, because they would not fund the increased jail. So over these many 19 years, there's been many people that I've worked with very closely. Some of you I see in the room. I would cite the Ohio Innocence Project and the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. I see Stephen Johnson Grove and Kevin Warner here. I made the original introduction of Jim Petro to the Ohio Innocence Project, which launched their famous work throughout Ohio. Terry Collins and Director Moore, two of the directors of DRC, were big influencers. Terry Collins summed it all up. We have to decide who we're really afraid of and who we're just mad at, and make that kind of decision about who goes to prison and who doesn't. I worked very closely over the years with my friends at Talbert House and the Community Corrections Association. We have a very robust system in Ohio of community corrections, and that's one of the plus sides of criminal justice reform in Ohio. And of course, Justice Stratton, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention her as an influencer on the great work she's done around mental health issues. She's really been an all-star in that regard. So those are the folks that I've listened to and try to work with, and obviously my able friend and adversary here, we have to deal with them all the time. But we work through these issues as best we can, and all the other panelists are right. These are the reasons, both financial and human, why we are having this seminar today.
Good morning, I'm Lou Tobin. I'm the Executive Director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. I think, as Representative Seitz just said, we are often the adversary on these reform topics, and I think we're viewed in some for people to understand that the prosecutor's viewpoint and the prosecutor's main goal in their communities is to keep the community safe, to secure justice for the victims of crime, and public safety. And I think what most of them see in their communities, particularly when we're talking about these quote-unquote low-level drug offenses, is that drug possession and drug addiction drive all sorts of other worse types of crime, from domestic violence all the way up to murder. And, you know, violent offenses are driven by addiction and drug offenses. That said, I think it's also important to understand that prosecutors have also grown to appreciate the nature of addiction. And I think prosecutors have been at the forefront in this state of creating diversion programs to make sure that people aren't being convicted of felonies. I think they've been at the forefront of creating drug courts across the state of Ohio to make sure that people can get into treatment and can walk away without the stigma of a felony conviction. So we're not completely anti-reform, but our view is that there comes a point where you've got to have a big enough stick to encourage a person to get into treatment, to get well, and to get their life back together. And it's our view that reform undermines all of that.
All right. Thank you all very much, and we appreciate you being here with us this morning. And so you've all talked about the efforts and your role in criminal justice reform. And as we know, and many of us probably have been involved for more years than we like to admit, we've seen the issue of criminal justice reform kind of ebb and flow. There's been bipartisan support, popular support, but we continue to have this conversation here in Ohio. So how would you say, from your perspective, the trend, so to speak, of criminal justice reform has played out, and how do we move that ball forward and move on from the continued conversation of criminal justice reform and actually have some tangible things that maybe we all can agree upon? And Rep. Seitz, I'll let you start with that one.
Well, you know, I would take the rest of the hour to list out all of the criminal justice reform bills that we have passed and done over the last 10 years. Obviously, House Bill 86, which was my bill, worked on for years, and it made a number of signal changes, raising the theft threshold for felonies, equalizing the penalties between crack and powder cocaine, providing that first-time F4 and F5 nonviolent offenders would not be sent to prison, but rather given community control if there was such alternative available in the county, establishing a statewide risk assessment system, which at the time we thought was the best there was, ORIS, which is still being used. We can debate whether there are other better ones. I don't know. We put term limits on the parole board, and we have a very good parole board now that is actually starting to release people on parole, which is a good thing, because they used to just say no, nature of the offense, nature of the offense, nature of the offense. Now they're doing a better job of realizing that you can never change the nature of the offense. We need to look at the offender's conduct while in prison. We took our first steps in that bill on wider expungement and sealing, a trend that is accelerated with numerous bills, most notably including Senate Bill 66 from last session, that greatly expand the number of times that you can get felonies and misdemeanors, low-level felonies and misdemeanors, expunged. Justice O'Connor is building on that through House Bill 1, which we've already passed in the House. We had the TCAP program, which is, I think, a great program that sort of incentivizes local judges not to send folks to prison. We had Senate Bill 332, which was a bill I did with Senator Shirley Smith, bringing into play the concept of a certificate of qualifications for employment, reducing barriers to reemployment. We also have the certificate of achievement and employability. We just passed a bill recently in the House to further widen that. It's Senate Bill 5, standardizing the fees for CQEs. We're trying to get these folks reintegrated into society. So there's been a long, long list, and I can't do it all justice in the limited time, but I think there's plenty of work still to be done. And I didn't know if your question encompassed what, why haven't we done more? Is that part of your question?
Yeah, we're going to get there eventually.
Okay, well, you know, I'll just offer some high-level thoughts on that, because I knew that was going to be the main topic of this session. I cite in descending order three reasons why the prisons are still too full. Reason number one, we had, since we started down this road in 2011, we've had the onslaught of heroin and fentanyl. And that's really serious stuff. And so we've had a great uptick in the number of people going to prison for heroin and fentanyl. That didn't exist to this extent at all in 2011. So that's number one. That's been the biggest reason why our prison population has not dropped as much as we would have liked. Reason number two, judges were reluctant to use the tools that we gave them. Judicial release, which we broadened in House Bill 86, very reluctant to use judicial release in many, many parts of the state. Similarly, we had earned credit, and it was a modest earned credit program, 8% earned credit is the maximum we could get out of these guys at the time, and that was kicking and screaming. But you know, there's plenty of opportunities for the judges to use the tools that we gave them. But they seem to have been reluctant to do so. And then the third reason is on us, not me necessarily, but the legislature, as they continue to, whenever, you know, I have a rule, whenever somebody comes in with a law and it's named after somebody, it's probably a bad idea, okay? Because it's a one-off case, it's a sad case, it gets a lot of media attention, and lo and behold, we're gonna change the criminal code because of one sad case. And we've had some of that. I think it's receded in recent years, mainly because I've tried my best to derail these sentencing enhancement bills. But now you've got Governor DeWine with a whole package of sentencing enhancements as part of his gun violence approach. And I think most of that is misplaced, frankly. How many times can we get after these people? We have a repeat violent offender law, which provides enhanced penalties on repeat violent offenders. And about 3 years ago, along comes General DeWine and Jim Hughes and says, well, now we need a violent career criminal law. And I'm thinking, well, we already have a repeat violent offender law, but we passed the violent career criminal law. And now everything that they didn't get in that bill that they wanted, they're back asking for now as part of Governor DeWine's gun violence program. So all these things are going to have an impact on our friends at DRC and the hotels that they provide in Ohio. And I certainly hope we don't get to the point where people have to build, where we build a new prison. I've heard rumors, frankly, that the governor is prepared to ask for money to build a new prison. And I think that would be a terrible shame because these things are not cheap. And many of my colleagues that want to pass sentencing enhancement bills would be the first to say, I'm not voting for increased spending. I can't have a tax increase to pay. I won't vote for that. But yet they keep passing these bills to increase the penalty on this, that, and the other thing. And I think those are the three main things that are standing in the way of more holistic criminal justice reforms that we need to consider.
Thank you, Representative. So, Chief Justice O'Connor, what would you say your top three obstacles are if you had to couch or phrase things that may be obstacles to reform, or why we continue to have the conversation and maybe haven't moved the needle forward, or other people becoming woke, as you said? How do we get there?
I think that there's some impediments that are inherent in the institutions that we have to progress. I commend Representative Seitz for his extensive list of successes that the legislature has passed. He mentioned number two and number three as his reasons why we are not as reformed as one would think that we should be given the tools that are at hand. Judges are reluctant to use judicial release and the certifications for employment, et cetera, and why is that? Because judges are elected, and that is an impediment. Judges, I know from having been a common pleas court judge, although these things were not around when I was a common pleas court judge, but it's no different today than it was, in the mid-90s. Judges have to be elected, and there's oftentimes where there's just that one case that can get you unelected the next time around. And judges have a mind towards that, and so I think that that's an impediment. That truly is an impediment for judges to embrace fully tools like judicial release, other decisions that have to be made by the judge that are directly impact on the defendant, for fear that that defendant is going to go out into the community and do something that is going to reflect on the judge, and come election time that's going to, and that's human. I mean, that's just human nature. You know, a judge, I know what their rationale is. I'm really doing a good job, and I don't want to be torpedoed by one case, and who can blame them? That's the system that we find ourselves in. Should we reform the way we select judges in this state? I have advocated that for years, that we do so. But there hasn't been an appetite for that, Representative Seitz.
I think it's what you're saying.
the legislative focus. Again, legislators, as the set of the
Representative has so eloquently stated, sometimes their focus is misdirected to one sad case or, one perception of how this needs to be dealt with, because this is going to be the bigger perception because, again, they're elected. And I don't think there's any way around having your legislature elected, so I'm not advocating for that. But there's few, or not having them non-elected, I'm not advocating for that. But I don't know if there is the appetite for the boldness that is necessary to take place in order to truly impact reform and the system that we have. And, people can sit in the audience and say, well, that's easy for her to say. She's in her last term as Chief Justice, and she's never going to run for office again, so she can, afford to be bold and make these kind of statements. But that's not it. I would be saying these things. In fact, I did say these things when I was eligible for re-election. Fortunately, I got re-elected. It's under the umbrella of the system, the institutions we have that don't encourage reform and don't encourage taking the type of stands that may be controversial because of how that will ultimately reflect on the individual.
As far as what the Chief Justice has just said about boldness and how to affect that change, how do you think organizations and interest groups like yours, like the Buckeye Institute, fit into that perspective? And how can you guys and others like your groups help move kind of a cultural shift, I guess would be the best way for me to think about saying it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think one of the things that we try to add, one of the things we try to add is, it is okay to be conservative and be in favor of criminal justice reform. I would say that Representative Seitz is a pretty conservative representative, and he's been a great champion, and we have the Chief Justice, who's a great champion of a lot of our criminal justice reform efforts. And so I think that what we try to do is we try to provide research and information as to why, regardless of what your goal is in the criminal justice system, whether it's the human aspect, whether you're looking at a fiscal analysis, whether you're looking at public safety, the data actually shows that we're all wanting the same reforms. And we can argue about the minutia and how we get there, but generally I think there's a broad agreement that we should be moving in the same direction. And I'll just say that I think that incrementalism is how we've gotten here, and it's how we're getting our way out. Representative Seitz talked about House Bill 86, Senate Bill 66, TCAP and things. And I think that's been slowly rolling us towards what we're actually looking at doing now in House Bill 1 and Senate Bill 3. In fact, Lou may not appreciate this, but I'll steal a line that he gave in his testimony about Senate Bill 66. If the General Assembly wants to treat these offenses as offenders as misdemeanants, then they should make it a misdemeanor. And I think that's the direction that we're moving. And I applaud the General Assembly. I think that that because of the past reforms, we're actually on a good path, and we're prepared to make that next step.
So, Lou, in your conversation earlier, I think you said something about prosecutors sometimes are seen as obstructionists, and that you're really interested as a group in reform efforts and trying to increase opportunities for people who come through. The chief mentioned the election component of that perspective. Do you think that impacts prosecutorial decisions?
I really don't.
Okay.
Certainly not to a very large extent, as when compared to, I think, what really drives a person to be a prosecutor, and that's securing justice for victims and promoting public safety in their communities. I think prosecutors' decisions are really driven by those two things. And I, just if I could touch on just a couple of things that the other panelists said. One thing that I think people should understand is, we talk about how the prisons are overcrowded and how we have this prison overpopulation problem. Before House Bill 86, the prison population was hovering around 50,000. At the time, then DRC Director Gary Moore was projecting that the prison population would rise to 53,500 by 2015. And I think it's safe to say that without reforms, it probably would have increased by another 3,000 or 3,500 by now in the last 4 years. So I think reform and all of that, we've reduced the prison population by a couple of thousand, and when compared to where it was projected to go by now, we've reduced it by 6,000 or 7,000. So I think it's a mistake to say that the reforms that Ohio has enacted haven't had an impact. I think they have had an impact. We've just been in the midst of an opiate crisis. And the other thing I'll say is, I think it's important to understand when you ask about what the obstacles to reform are, people voted against State Issue 1 last fall by a margin of 2-1. So we can debate all day what the reasons were for people's votes, but I think what most prosecutors heard from their communities was, we think this is a bad idea. We think that there needs to be some accountability for people. We've gotten away from accountability. We think this is bad for public safety. Overwhelmingly, that's what the voters said in the vote on Issue 1 last year. So, when 66% of voters are saying we don't want these drug possession offenses decreased to misdemeanors, I think that's a pretty big obstacle to some of the types of reforms that are being discussed.
Thank you. Chief?
And I agree with what the panelists have contributed here, but there's just one, actually maybe two things that I take a little bit of a different approach. With Lou, one of your opening statements was that the job of the prosecutor is to do justice for the victims. As a former elected prosecutor, I would differ and say that it's for justice for all, the defendants and the victims. It's not just a victim-focused institution. It cannot be. Our oath and our responsibility as elected prosecutors are to do justice for all, and that encompasses defendants as well. So we as an institution, and when I say the institution, it's the state and it's the criminal justice system, have to take our victims as we find them, of course, but we also have to take the defendants as we find them. And we do have a drug epidemic in this state, and it has made defendants out of people who may not otherwise have been defendants. It's because of their addiction. And we just can't throw them away, and we just can't say, well, it's a one-size-fits-all, because we know that that's not the case. And one of my criticisms, and it's been a criticism all along, is that when they are in prison, and there's plenty of information about recidivism after prison, and it doesn't help the defendant or the inmate, et cetera, it's lack of programming in prison and lack of treatment in prison. I would be all for building another prison if that prison treated drug-addicted inmates, and they did it at the level of the Betty Ford Clinic, that we had a true institution that could deal with the latest methods of treating addiction and do it universally. And I know that that's an expensive proposition, but if we're going to put people in prison, and there are some people that need to be in prison, and they also happen to be drug addicted, there ought to be the resources in our prison system that's going to give them top-of-the-line drug treatment so that they can, we all know that they are going to leave prison for the most part someday, and you want them to leave clean, educated, and motivated.
You've been kind of quiet and taking it all in on the obstacles and where we've been. From your perspective and your organization's interests, how best can we move this conversation forward?
There's a couple of things. So the idea of somebody leaving prison clean and motivated is one that I want to start with. First and foremost, all of the research, evidence, and data that has been collected examining other states and federal government data from both the Pew Institute, from Pew Charitable Trust, as well as the Urban Institute, have found some key factors that lead us to, we are in a different place. We know much more now than we knew 30, 40 years ago. Felony convictions are effective at doing a couple of things, and I'll outline them. They are effective at delaying access to treatment. They are effective at increasing unemployment and inhibiting earning potential. Felonies are also really great at preventing people from accessing housing. What felonies are not good at is resolving addiction. So when we're specifically talking about a group of people whose challenge is drug addiction and drug use, states have evaluated this and have moved in a different direction, recognizing that so many state dollars were going towards incarcerating these people and settling them with felony convictions. We now know that that is problematic and it's not effective. I will agree with the chief in that there are some people who do need to be incarcerated. That's not who we're talking about with regard to folks who are simply being settled with a felony for their struggles for possessing a small amount of drugs. So we're in the Supreme Court. We have to make sure that we're focused on evidence, facts, data that's collected, and the analysis of that data. This is not 1980. I commend the legislature for their just continued leadership, and it started with Representative Seitz in many ways. advancing the most comprehensive criminal justice reform, House Bill 86, that the state has seen. But there's a key piece that we have not mentioned yet, and it's how that plays out in the local level. While our state representatives and senators are working hard to advance reforms, those reforms have to be enacted at the local level. And I want to take a moment to just highlight a key piece from a report that was released by the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. And this was the transition report that happens when we have a new administration. Reading from the report directly. Courts and prosecutors have claimed that despite the challenges made to the community control statute, ambiguity exists in the interpretation and have relied on the ambiguity and alternative interpretation of the statute to continue to sentence violators to 6 to 18 months in prison, violators of probation, which make up 23% of our incoming prison population. Despite the fact that previous legislation capped those terms of probation to 90 and 180 days, adherence to this language, which was passed in House Bill 49, was at 20%. The closing line, the lack of adherence to the caps imposed on House Bill 49 has had an immediate and lasting effect on our budget, both for fiscal year 18 and fiscal year 19. It's important that we talk about every aspect of Ohio. There is the work that happens here in the state legislature. Our elected, and I support elections of judges and representatives and senators. Our elected officials are working really hard to resolve these issues because they're also the ones who are responsible for passing our state budget. Given that in mind, those laws and reforms have to be implemented at the local level. So it's important that we recognize that, that's what we're dealing with, but it's also key that we need to be reflective about where we have been as a state, where other states are moving. Those states who have passed reclassification of minor drug possession from a felony to a misdemeanor have also seen the biggest decreases in their prison population and decreases in crime.
Thank you. So, Representative Seitz.
Let me jump in on that. First of all, I appreciate Shakira's very good comments there and her kind words about me. Everybody here, where we go. And I absolutely agree with her that one of the great undone matters that needs attention is this business of sending people back to prison for technical parole violations. Now, we can have a nice big long debate about what's a technical parole violation, but where I come from, just because somebody has not satisfactorily passed a urine test does not mean they are should be sent back to prison. Okay? Addiction is a long, hard thing to overcome. And I know DRC and the Justice Reinvestment Task Force that I co-chaired was a task force created by Justice O'Connor, the Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, the Governor Kasich, have recommended we need to do more in that area, and the courts need to quit sliding around what we're trying to do, which is to reduce the number of people sent back to prison for technical parole violations. I agree with her about that. But what we also have to do is we have to build up the local probation and parole infrastructure. We have a problem. We've got way too many people being supervised by way too few people. And I think Governor DeWine has just announced that he wants to do something about that. The Reagan-Tokes Act Part 2, which is pending before us, will do something about that. That needs to work in tandem with a reduction in technical parole violation returns to prison. Where I disagree with Shakira a little bit is, look, Justice O'Connor has given me plenty of studies that say you have to treat this as a felony in order to get these people into drug courts, number one. Number two, the fact is we do not have drug courts in enough municipal courts throughout Ohio for them to be able to handle all the misdemeanor cases were we to reclassify minor drug offenses from felony to misdemeanor. We have drug courts in every county. We have drug courts in a very small fraction of municipal courts in Ohio. And so, look, I'm
we're not the experts. You all are the experts. But when we're confronted with diametrically opposed studies, Shakira's got her studies, Justice O'Connor's got her studies, what are we supposed to do? That's difficult. We need to try to come to some consensus. And then the final thing is, we keep talking about minor drug possession offenses. Well, that begs the question of what's minor. And I think to Lou's point, a lot of people voted no on state issue one because once they realized that you could have enough fentanyl and be considered a misdemeanor to kill many hundreds, if not thousands of people, they said, nah, baby, nah, this is going a little too far. So I don't think the voters were necessarily against the concepts of state issue one, but I think they went way overboard in deciding what is minor drug possession, particularly as applied to heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, and other killers like that. And I know Lou has some valid concerns about Senate Bill 3 as to where they've chosen to draw the line on what is a minor amount of cocaine, what is a minor amount of this, that, and the other thing. We need to work through those issues. But I'm not sure that, I am not sure. In fact, I tend today to lean towards not reclassifying from felony to misdemeanor, but saying that if the person completes treatment, they will either get intervention in lieu of conviction completely, or at worst, some sort of an unclassified misdemeanor on their record, because she's absolutely right about all the other things that attend a felony that operate as a more or less permanent inhibitor towards that person becoming reintegrated into society by way of housing and job opportunities and so forth.
So one thing I just want to respond very quickly to that. Comparing both common pleas and municipal drug courts, the data shows exactly the same, that what and they graduate at the same rate. There is no difference. What people need is a pathway towards treatment, which I believe everyone here can agree to. What people do not need when they're struggling with addiction and they're going, their conviction is specifically around low-level minor drug possession, is to be saddled with additional barriers. If there's a way that we can get folks to treatment without the felony, we should take that path, which is why Senate Bill 3 is so important.
Lou and Daniel and the chief, and then hopefully have time for a couple of questions. So, Lou?
Well, first, on the issue of what a personal possession amount of a drug is, you know, we don't think that there is any personal possession amount of a drug like heroin that can kill a person the first time they use it or create an addiction the first time they use it. So, I think just the term itself, personal possession amount of these deadly drugs, is troubling to us. But what I really want to get into is this idea that we have too many felony drug possession offenders that are going to prison. They're going to prison for the wrong reasons. They're going to prison for technical violations and probation violations. The real in the real world, prosecutors, judges, sheriffs, anybody else in the community that deals with these criminal justice issues will tell you that by the time a person gets sent to prison on a drug possession offense, they've failed out of a diversion program, they failed out of intervention in lieu, they violated their community control 4, 5, or 6 times, and the system locally is simply out of options. The Chief Justice wrote a letter to Senator Eklund and Senator O'Brien, the sponsors of Senate Bill 3, a couple of months ago, and she did some background research on this group of felony 4 and felony 5 offenders who are first-time offenders in prison. And what her letter found was that there are about 309. We did some additional research into that with our prosecutors, and I just want to talk about one of these cases. In this case, it was a person who was a first-time F5 drug possession offender who was in prison. But this person had gone through a diversion program, failed out of diversion, been offered ILC, violated ILC, was continued on ILC, violated ILC again, was placed on community control, violated community control, was continued on community control with an amended sentence to a CBCF, a community behavioral correctional facility, walked away from the community behavioral health facility, was sent to jail for 20 days, and then continued on community control, violated community control again, and then was sent to prison. So my question is, what do you do with a person like that? And I would agree with the Chief Justice entirely
that I think the real solution is some sort of long-term lockdown facility where we can send drug addicted offenders for treatment.
Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, so I think that one of the pieces of information that may be missing is, so we have TCAP in the state of Ohio. 60 of our counties participate because it's a voluntary program. And in that program, the counties are granted money from the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction in exchange for not sending felony five offenders to prison. So I looked into it. We have, I think, 114 drug courts in the state of Ohio, 85 of which are in TCAP counties, meaning that 85 of our drug courts already cannot send felony five drug offenders to prison. It's just taken off the table, and I have not heard anything saying that has inhibited the drug courts there. And then, you know, talking about what stops reform, circling back to that, it's exactly this. It's these anecdotes, these what-if scenarios that are constantly raised that prohibit reform. And we always hear nobody's going to prison for drug possession, or we hear, you know, I don't think that somebody should go to prison for drug possession or from suffering from addiction. But, and then there's this long what if scenario, and we need to be able to have this hammer of a felony conviction in order to coerce somebody to do what we want them to do. And my response is, if they do something that we all agree, or the majority of us agree, is worthy of a felony, then let's convict them of a felony and let's send them to prison. But otherwise, we should not have artificially high sentences that people agree should not be imposed just to coerce people into what we think they should do.
What's your solution to the scenario I just described?
So I think that this may not be a popular answer, but drug laws are prophylactic in nature, right? So I would say the majority of people don't really care that people are doing drugs. What we care about is that they might overdose, that they might die. We worry about how this impacts their family relations. We worry about how this might impact their community, but it might lead them to additional crime. And so, you know, once those things manifest themselves and happen, then let's convict them of the crime that they actually committed that it warrants a felony.
So, Chief, you want to say a few words, and then we have about 5 minutes for questions, if you stick to 2 minutes.
I'll just try to be very brief.
First of all, there are numerous studies out there. I think the
Pew study has been referred to and some others. I don't disagree with the contents, because those studies are predicated on if you send people to prison and they don't get treatment. We universally agree. The response to someone who is addicted to a substance, whether it be alcohol all the way up to fentanyl, is treatment. If you have someone who is an addict and that is their offense, their possession and it's, you know, personal use, et cetera, or low level amount, whatever that may be, I think that under HB 1, your first option as a court is to put them in treatment in lieu. And get them treatment, have them in the community, have all the other, you know, requirements attached. And I don't think anybody disagrees that that's a good way to go with these folks, because at the end of the day, they don't have a felony, and they're exposed to treatment and participating in treatment for a period of time, 18 months, maybe 24 months, sometimes longer. Okay, so I think that I would hope would be universally agreed upon, and understand that that's a much cheaper option than putting someone in, you know, our state institution. Now, as far as whether somebody needs to, the success of misdemeanor drug court versus a felony drug court, there's a study out of Texas, and I think it's a 2018 study, the relative influence of legal pressure on outcomes in a rehabilitation aftercare drug court, legal pressure being the court. The court is the only institution in our society that has that type of influence, that type of accountability, and that type of ability to mandate treatment for individuals who find themselves on the wrong side of the law. This report, again, out of Texas, which found significantly lower success rates and higher relapse rates for individuals charged with misdemeanors versus those charged with felonies. And, you know, it's in the study. I would ask you to take a look at this study. So to say that, you know, misdemeanor is as good as a felony, and, you know, I would think that the other fallacy in an argument like that is if somebody puts themselves in treatment, that's a great thing, and we should just let that, you know, take its course. Well, you'll hear from all of the treatment professionals that someone who signs themselves up for treatment, their success rate is negligible compared to someone who has found themselves in treatment because of a court order. It's the court order that gets these folks to stick with their program and the consequences of what happens in a relapse. So talk to the treatment community. This is not something that I'm making up. It's something that is verified.
Shakira, let's take a couple questions and we can, unfortunately, talk outside the panel. So, are there questions, Judge Nichols? I see, and I know you'll boom the question,
no,
so you don't need a microphone.
My name is Bob Nichols. I'm a retired common pleas judge. I've been dealing with these issues since 1967. I hesitate to say, how have we gotten to the point that the criminal justice system is a primary conduit to treatment? Ms. Diaz has spoken about prevention. We hear very little about prevention. We hear over and over again about the cost of incarceration and that treatment is cheaper than incarceration. Prevention stops both of those. What efforts are being made, either with think tanks or with the legislature? What is being done to raise issues of prevention and avoid these problems?
That's a fiscal question. When we have a majority of our state dollars going towards one response and not diversifying the very reality that we do need better treatment options in the state of Ohio, I think that's the issue at hand. Secondly, it would be great to be able to see a study about Ohio's drug courts. Unfortunately, we do not collect any data about Ohio's drug courts, who's going in, the criteria for folks to get in, how are folks being denied. So it'd be great to see some comprehensive data there. I can't speak to a municipal drug court in the state of Ohio, the Cleveland Municipal Drug Court, which is one of the longest lasting drug courts in the state, that has been very effective at ensuring that people get access to treatment minus being saddled with a felony conviction.
Real quick on the prevention issue, there's renewed interest in civil commitment as a way of dealing with a problem short of incarceration. We had Governor Kasich had a prevention program called Start Talking. I'm not sure how effective it was, but that was his grand idea. I think you're going to find a lot more money put into prevention as a result of these opiate settlements that are being concluded either by the state or local governments. A big chunk of that is going to go towards prevention. So I think there will be a renewed focus on prevention. And we've always had the DARE program, which doesn't do much because it's like one grade. And when you're in like third grade, and by the time they get in high school, they forget all about it. So yes, that is something we need to focus on. And those are some of the initiatives that are out there to try to get us more into a prevention related mode.
All right, we can take one more question. Yes, ma'am. We don't have a roving microphone. Thank you. Anyone?
No, I was just raising my hand.
Yes. So I grew up in a town in eastern Ohio called East Liverpool.
East Liverpool is somewhat infamous in the last couple of years during the opiate epidemic for pictures that made the national news about two parents overdosing in the front seat with their child in the back seat. Three people that I went to high school with, a couple of people that I considered friends, have died from drug overdoses. I think it's a problem that has touched, you know, it's not anecdotal, or I think it's a problem that has touched every Ohioan. So, yes, to answer your question.
I think the impact, I think your question is the effect of a felony on your record, if I'm reading between your
lines of your question, and the detrimental effect of a felony. Well, the response to that is getting the record sealed and having that individual going into court, getting the record sealed so they no longer have a felony. HB 1 allows for that. Treatment in lieu of conviction, you know, allows for that and expands the number of times that you can get your felony record, your low-level felony record, sealed. So, you know, the number of cases that you can have in or and still get your record sealed. So we're mindful of that, and that is, I think, a solution to. You know, I know the argument is, well, somebody needs to have a misdemeanor and not have a felony on their record. A misdemeanor, based on the studies, will not prompt someone to get the treatment necessary. They will not enter a misdemeanor drug court because that's hard work. And I know from experience of being a common police court judge and hearing from other judges in this state that the response is, you know, if I'm going to get 6 months, I can do 6 months. I'm not going to have the state making me pee in a bottle and monitor everything I'm doing for the next 18 to 24 months or longer. It's just not going to happen.
All right. Thank you, Chief. That's a great segue into our next panel that focuses on House Bill 1 and Senate Bill 3. Please join me in thanking our panelists for their time today.